them to do it if I'm not willing to lead in that way. So I got a lot out of the book too. What the young people told me, they really enjoy the reading of Leviticus. And I hope I can encourage that kind of thinking with you today. It's an honor and a privilege. I believe there are many others that could do better than I do. But I know I emphasize the right things. I know you need to read the Bible. There is nothing in the Bible you should ignore. Even the book of Leviticus. Sometimes a person might think, well, I don't know if I need that book. But the New Testament takes me back to that book. And so to begin, I'd like for you to open your Bibles to 1 Peter chapter 1. And I want to see that bridge that takes me back to the book of Leviticus. In chapter 1, verse 13, we begin our reading. Therefore, gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and rest your hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lust as in your ignorance, but as he who calls you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, because it is written, be holy, for I am holy. And if you call on the Father, who without partiality judges according to each one's work, conduct yourselves throughout the time of your stay here in fear, knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold from your aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. He indeed was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but was manifest in these last times for you, who through him believe in God, who raised him from the dead, gave him glory, so that your faith and your hope are in God. Now, Peter takes us back by saying it is written. And I would say anytime you read anything in the New Testament that is quoted from the Old Testament, you ought to go back there. And you need to know more about it. When I did the study with my junior high class, I told them I didn't want them to take pride in the fact we're studying something that many people don't study. And so you might could get bragging rights. No, you don't want that. You study so that you can come to know God. And the closer you get, the better it will be for you, because we become, this is not a phrase unique to me, but we become what we worship. If you worship the vanity of this world, you become vain. Absolutely. And if you worship God, and the more you do that, and the more you bring your focus upon him, you become more like God. You were made in his image for a purpose. You were made to be like him. And so the idea of holiness is a beautiful thought. You know, it's essential, because the writer of Hebrews tells me, without holiness, no one, that means no exception, no one will see God. And I would say all of us here want to see God, but you can't do it without holiness. And so that's why we want to appreciate, be holy, for I am holy. Now, that takes me to the book of Leviticus. And I want to go there to see the first of the three times. I won't do the other two today. But the first said that three times God says, be holy for I am holy. Now, why do you think God would repeat that? And why would he repeat it three times? It's not because God's saying, I've got to write a book here and I just need to fill it with something. And so I'll just repeat, be holy for I am holy. No, it's repeated for emphasis. And so you want to realize, even in the New Testament, whatever is repeated is meant for you to take a clue that this is being emphasized. Sometimes our parents, when we're younger, they will give us a command, something to do, and then they come back and say, well, did you hear me? And then they repeat the command, just in case you don't remember. But that's emphasis. And if God does it, then we want to pick up on that emphasis. Well, going to the book of Leviticus, I would like for you to go to chapter 11, where it's quoted for the first time. It's an unusual setting because we're talking about clean and unclean animals. And it's in that context that God says, be holy, for I am holy. I want you to see the statement in chapter 11, verse 44, for I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore consecrate yourselves, and you shall be holy, for I am holy. Neither shall you defile yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth. For I am the Lord who brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. This is the law of the animals and the birds, every living creature that moves on or moves in the water, and every creature that creeps on the earth. To distinguish, I don't have enough time to emphasize this one, to distinguish between the unclean and the clean, and between animals that may be eaten and animals that may not be eaten. Now, distinguishing. Leviticus is going to emphasize that word too. And between clean and unclean, I think today a lot of us don't know what to say when we say, well, I can't go to these movies and I can't listen to that music. And somebody, well, what's the big deal? The big deal is those are not holy things. And you will need to learn to show how to distinguish them to others. And that's where teaching comes in. The responsibility of the priests and the Levites were to learn to distinguish and then practice, then teach. And that's the same process that we need. We need to learn, and we need to practice, and we need to be able to teach. And this is a lifelong endeavor. Now, one thought from this passage, you may recall that how the Lord revealed, how the Lord, the Bible will say in New King James, showed Peter not to call any man clean or unclean. Well, how did he show him that? He let down the sheep from heaven, Acts chapter 10, and there are all kinds of animals in there, and he told, rise up, kill and eat. Peter said something that I wish more people would pick up on. He said, I've never done that. That implies something. He's a conscientious man. He's very careful. And a lot of times people get this idea that Peter's like a sailor in the modern world, goes to a different port, and he lives a very rugged, rough, ungodly life. That's not Peter of the Bible. Not even before the Lord called him to be an apostle. He said, I've never done that. I want to gain respect for that. But if he's never done it, and he begins to see it, he could tell Cornelius, God has showed me. And it's interesting that at a time, Gentiles would be unclean in the fabric of their society. Now then, you cannot make unclean those who are declared to be clean. Well, I want you to go to the book of Leviticus chapter 1. Now, the idea of being holy, up here in this definition is not wrong. I just want to add a little bit to it. The word holy means to set apart. That's exactly it. But you want to think, set apart for what? And set apart why? Well, that begins to enrich your study of the holiness of God. To set apart, at least if you like my working definition, means to do so to protect it. I have a friend I serve with as an elder. He has a, maybe this doesn't mean a lot to some, but he has a Mickey Mantle baseball card that he got when he was a young man. And I read on the internet some of those things could be expensive. And I could tell he enjoyed showing that to me. Now, I know he wouldn't pass it to a little boy. I'm a grandfather now. He won't pass it to my grandson very soon, especially if he's like 4 or 5, he's got peanut butter and jelly on his hands. No, it's not quite that object that he would want to pass to him. You see, we set it apart. But we also set apart, but you got to learn something about setting apart. You got to know where it is when you set it apart. And I think sometimes we're so careless. In my house, we've been doing a lot of renovation for maybe like my wife says, 7 years. We're making progress, but very slowly. And someone would have said, bring me the measuring tape. Well, I know I have one, but I may not know where it is. It's set apart, but that would not be set apart if you don't know where it is in a holy way. You know, you can think God's in my life, and I believe he is in your life in so many ways. But if you don't know how to bring who God is in any given moment, then you've lost him in some ways. And you don't want to lose God in your life. Another thing about setting apart, you do it to display, like my friend did. He showed me. I have this Mickey Mantle baseball card. And he let me handle it. You know, I think my hands didn't have any peanut butter and jelly on it. And so I'd look at it, and I can remember those days. It was good. I think when we talk about God, we want to display him to the world. We want people to know that God's in our lives. And this is a thought I heard in a gospel meeting not too far back. When people think you're a good person and they don't know you're a Christian, you're a good person for your own self-gratification. And that's not good for you. If you are a good person, it's because of the presence of God in your life. And I try to do, and I'm always thinking about those things that will please him. One of my favorite arguments for parents with their children is children obey your parents. Pause. Not because you love me, but I think love and obedience have something in common. Not because I put food on the table. My kids have brought home a pizza, and they would imagine they don't have to be obedient to me because they put food on the table. I don't want them to obey me because they think I'm stronger than they are. Neither my son or my daughter could whip me right now. I don't have a lot of physical strength. And so I can't make them do something. Then what's my argument? I had one lady when I was doing this lesson, she came up to me. I was thinking, you're running out of arguments for children to obey you. I thought the best one is, Paul told the Colossians, children, obey your parents, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. You want to be holy? You learn all along the way, even with your obedience, because this would please the Lord. And if you don't please Him, you're missing out on what He wants you to be. You're missing out on holiness that becomes that essential factor for you to be able to see God. Now, I want to take you to chapter 1 to take away your fear of Leviticus. A lot of times when people see the book of Leviticus, they say, well, that's just for the Levites. And we're not Levites. And I don't know that I need this book. And it's going to be too complicated. All those sacrifices and the things that they do, I'm not even old enough, maybe, to study the book of Leviticus. But my junior high class, they would prove you wrong. One of them now is out of college, and where he attends, they asked him to do the book of Leviticus. And he did a great job, what I hear. You see, it's something that can be with you, not just get me through school or Sunday morning or Wednesday night. It's something that can stay with you for your life. And so I want you to know the book of Leviticus. Let me introduce you to the book, verses 1 and 2. I'm thinking about, in the future, maybe preaching the first chapter of every book of the Bible. In a way, I feel like if you get started well, you've got a journey that you know what you'd be looking for. So, in verses 1 and 2, now the Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tabernacle of meeting, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of the livestock, of the herd, and of the flock. Just those two verses. You may already know this. Little paragraphs in our Bibles tell us what the name was a long, long time ago, originally. And this book is called He Called. But the He is God. And so God called. Somebody say, well, that's interesting. Oh, I find it fascinating. In Luke chapter 2, when Mary gives her hymn, in the Catholic Bible, it's called the Magnificat of Mary. And it's called that because the first word in that hymn is the word magnify. And so I see that, and I think that is on spot. That's really good. And I really believe there's something to be said about He said. And we're talking about what God said. This isn't Mark Twain. This isn't any human author uninspired by God. This is what God said. It tells me He said it from the tabernacle of meeting. Could I give you a historical point here? In Exodus chapter 40, verse 17, the tabernacle has just been erected by Moses. You go to Numbers chapter 1, verse 1, the other side of the book of Leviticus. We're told a month later, in the same year, 1 month, the book of Leviticus is right in between. Now, that begins to tell me something. Genesis, no matter what you think about the number of years, almost anyone would concede at least 2,000 years. When you get to Exodus, you really slow down. We're talking about 81 years. You get to Leviticus and it's just 1 month. Now, what do you think slowing down shows you? Emphasis. If this is saying this is something that we need to get. Now, reading on. Speak to whom? It didn't say speak to the Levites. It said speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of the livestock, of the herd, and of the flock. Now, if you've grown up in Bible classes like I have, I recall that they were estimating because they'd have 600,000 fighting men. Well, they'd have wives, they'd have kids. They would be older people. You know, they're calculating easily 2 million. Some have said maybe 4 million. My favorite point is, speaking to all of them, it was narrowed down to the one. When any one. And that's why you need to read the Bible. For example, in the book of Revelation, the letter to all the churches is, let him who has ears to hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So why do I read the book of Romans? It's not one of the churches of Asia, but the Spirit spoke to them through the Apostle Paul. Why do I read the first and second letters of Corinthians? Corinth's not a church of Asia, but the Spirit spoke to them. And it's an individual responsibility. Even for the churches of Asia, the member in Ephesus needs to read all the letters written to all the churches of Asia. That should motivate us to follow in that path. Verse 3. Oh, and we've already emphasized, it's for everybody, not for the Levites. Verse 3. If his offering is a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish. He shall offer it of his own free will at the door of the tabernacle of meeting before the Lord. Now, that verse is packed with a lot of information for me. First of all, he offers a male. What would be involved in that? You know, living on a farm, even in the summer, I picked up on a few things. And I remember buying my first cow, a young cow, and I think I paid $150 back then. But my grandfather paid over $1,000 to have a bull. Now, why would that be the case? A bull can sire 25 calves a year. That's not just me talking. You can find that information out anywhere almost. A cow can only give one calf a year. Where do you think the future is? It's in the bull. And you're giving your best bull, you know, no blemish, no defect. Wouldn't you be tempted sometimes to say, well, I need to have options here. And this is maybe the best I have. You're willing to sacrifice the future of your herd to be faithful to the Lord. Well, without blemish, I will read, and it will, and I love this word, be accepted. I'm afraid we think of the word accept like in school, what's the minimum the teacher will permit, will allow? What will she accept? I remember one fellow telling me, I think it was Ed Harrell, he had people coming to him at a university level and asking, could they cut out pictures from National Geographic and paste it in a notebook. There. That seemed foolish to think about at a college level. But no, that wouldn't be accepted. They want you to do things that require work. But when you want God to accept you, the psalmist would say, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable to you, O Lord. Is that your goal? It's not carelessly done. It's purposely done. Everything about holiness is what you do on purpose. Reading on. And you shall bring it of your own free will. We live in a religious world today that debates that. There be many who say we don't have free will. And in some versions of the Bible, of your own free will is not included there. It's not that there's not words there to indicate it, but to think another translation would be better. Maybe so. But when I get into the book, I read about free will offerings. Free will, did it have problems because it was a compound word? But the way to understand any compound word is separate the two words. Free will. Offer it of your own free will. My family likes the next point, maybe the best. You bring it to the door of the tabernacle of meeting before the Lord. My kids kind of joke with me on this statement, but it's the right place and the right focus. All my life as a Christian, and I've congregated with many Christians in many different places of the world. I lived in Argentina for nearly 30 years. And one thing I was pleased to know, I was in the right place every first day of the week. I believe in the right place. That's taught in the Old Testament. You see, you don't get out in the wilderness the idea, I would like to go out into the desert and offer up a sacrifice to the Lord. Just my family. It would be more intimate that way. It might be, but it would not be accepted by God. There was one place. When the temple was built, there was just one place. All the other places would be called high places, but they would not be acceptable to the Lord. I believe there's something to be said about the right place. But I've been in the right place where I did not see the right focus. Before the Lord is a repeated refrain in the book of Leviticus. It communicates the idea of the presence of God. And so you want to be mindful of that, for example, when we partake of the Lord's Supper. The Lord did say, do this in remembrance of me. You can't be thinking about a football game. You can't be thinking about turkey around Thanksgiving or Christmas gifts under the tree. You can't even think about your homework at school. I don't even know why you'd want to do that, but, if you're going to have the right focus, it's going to be on God. Isn't that what we want in a relationship? In South America, and Chile in particular, they like to say, my wife's from Chile, so I get a lot of expressions here. They'll like to say when they love each other, with you, just bread and onions. By the way, I think bread and onions taste pretty good. But it's to say, we don't have to have anything. Just bread and onions. What is that? We're not focused on bread. We're not focusing on the onions. We're focused on the person that we will be with. And I think that's what we have to do with the Lord's Supper. Now, it's been a while since I've been in a situation where there was an elderly lady sitting pretty much in front of me while they were passing the Lord's Supper. And during that time, she was clipping her fingernails. Would you think she has the right focus? I know what a hangnail feels like. It just bothers you. You feel like I got, but she wasn't, I don't even think that's a reason to clip a hangnail. They're clipping the whole nail. She was at the right place, but she did not have the consciousness that she was before. You've got to think about those things. You can't be lazy. Holiness will not allow you to just say, well, I'll just sleep through this. I remember when I was a young boy listening to Sewell Hall, who invited me to hear to do a vacation Bible school class. I think now maybe 55 or 56 years ago, I was still in high school. But at the church where I attended in Birmingham, they had theater seats on that wall and this wall, not this building. And the young ladies didn't sit in the theater seats, but they sit on two rows. And the young men over here, the fellow right beside me, he'd be sleeping. He even had my same name. And he'd be snoring. People would be looking over there. I'd almost not want to be identified with him. You don't want to fall asleep in the presence of God. And when that time comes where it is a reality, you'll never be able to do that. You can't ignore God. You can't forget him. Some people try. But sooner or later, he makes himself present, either to welcome you or to judge you and condemn you. Right place, right focus. Sometimes when people read, they have a hard time with what I may call good grammar. I read where some people feel like grammar's a waste of time. No, I don't think that. The Bible is written. I don't think we're reading grammatical errors on the part of God. But I want you to see a division in verse 4 and following where we talk about he, remember, when anyone, when he comes, this is what he will do. And then I want to appreciate in the reading the word they. Who are the they in the reading? Well, I'm telling you up front, it's the priest. And the individual has to do something. And the priest will have to do what the individual could never do. And they work together in this situation. Let's read this a little bit. He shall put his hands on the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted on his behalf to make atonement for him. I like knowing that God will accept it before I do it. I don't know if we like it. It's not, I'll come and he'll just accept anything. No, it's not that way. He tells you what you want, what he wants before you get there. He shall kill the bull before the Lord. He, the individual there. You want to talk about passive participation? Nothing passive about what he is doing. He has to kill the animal. Could I dispel a thought from your mind? Mark art, when it shows Abraham about to kill Isaac on the altar, he has the knife held up high, and it gives the impression he will stab him to death. That's not the way sacrifices were made. It would slit the throat. And I think that'd be harder to imagine life draining out of your son. And by the way, if you want to think about Sammy and you have to collect that blood, can you imagine the challenge of blood just spattering everywhere, no way to really receive it, slitting the throat? They would receive that blood in a container and they would apply it. Blood has to be applied. Coming back though. He shall kill the bull before the Lord and the priest. Aaron's sons, they shall bring the blood and sprinkle the blood all around on the altar that is by the door of the tabernacle of meeting. And he, the worshiper, again, shall skin the burnt offering and cut it into its pieces. Some rabbis would say 12 pieces, thinking about the 12 tribes of Israel. The sons of Aaron, going back to the day, the priests shall put fire on the altar and lay the wood in order on the fire. Then the priests, Aaron's sons, shall lay the parts that have been cut up by the offerer. But the priest shall lay the parts, the head and the fat, in order on the wood that is on the fire upon the altar. But he, going back to the individual, shall wash its entrails and its legs with water. And the priest, going back to they, shall burn all on the altar as a burnt sacrifice, an offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to the Lord. That's the repeated refrain in this chapter. I go to verse 13. And I read the very end of verse 13. It is a burnt sacrifice, an offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to the Lord. And then at verse 17, we consider birds that could be, and they're not many, that could be sacrificed. But when I get to that conclusion, it is a burnt sacrifice, an offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to the Lord. A sweet aroma to the Lord's intent. Do you want it to be a sweet aroma to the Lord? Now, I want you to think about this. How many times do people tell me, maybe it's my fault they're failing in this way, but I hear it said, I didn't get anything out of worship services today. And I want to say, it wasn't meant for you. It's meant for the Lord. Did the Lord get something out of it? And you should be very concerned. And what is your participation in that process? You see, you have a lot to do with it being a sweet aroma to the Lord. Now, I try to tell people that, I want to make sure I don't use too much of the time here, but when I was a young boy, I didn't know a lot, but I thought, if there was a religious holiday in the Bible that I would like, it'd be the Feast of Tabernacles. Why? Everybody gets to go camping. I kind of liked that idea. And even people who lived in cities didn't live in their homes. They got out. Everybody is outside camping. And that's to help them to remember what it was like to go through the wilderness on their way to the promised land. I think as a boy, I would have loved that. The other thing I think I would have loved is peace offering. I'm not going there today, but just for a reference. The peace offering is the only offering where the participants could be the man that brought the offering and his family, and they could eat together. I think I would have loved that. Our being together, eating together. Now, the peace offering has another translation that I like. It's the offering of well-being. That's another translation for it. And what I want you to see, a lot of people think, I just go to the peace offering. No. I had a friend just say to me, well, I think Paul could have offered a peace offering. Well, I think he could. But you could never offer a peace offering without a burnt offering underneath. Can you see what I'm saying? There is a transition there in New Testament days. This thing is growing old and about to vanish. But if you're going to offer a peace offering, I want to appreciate, you can too if you keep on reading, I want to appreciate the levels. And the peace offering is above the burnt offering. You can't just independently have a peace offering. It's connected. And so, a lot of times we want to disconnect. We live in a time that loves the disconnect. But in the Old Testament, we're talking about a connection. Now, hopefully I've mentioned that the Holy Word in the book of Leviticus has been used 152 times. And if I didn't mention it, I'd mention it now. My son, years ago, when I made that observation, said, Dad, and he had read the book 3 times. He said, I see it a lot, but I don't think I see it 152 times. Well, I want to show you another way you can see it. In chapter 2, but in verse 3, I like saying the first 20 verses of Leviticus gives me all the information I want for a beginning. And you'll read, when anyone offers a grain offering to the Lord, his offering shall be of fine flour, and he shall pour oil on it and put frankincense on it. He shall bring it to Aaron's sons, the priests, one of whom shall take from it his handful of fine flour and oil with all the frankincense, and the priest shall burn it as a memorial. Memorial. That's what we see at the table. Do this in memory of me. The grain offering was a memorial. Trace that one down. An offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to the Lord. You see, we left chapter 1 and we're still talking about a sweet aroma to the Lord. Now here's verse 3. The rest of the grain offering shall be Aaron's and his sons. It is most holy of the offerings to the Lord made by fire. Would you like to know how the Hebrews made superlatives? Now, I know people say, I didn't come today to get a grammar lesson, but you're going to need a few. They don't have the superlative most. Good, better, and best. No, they don't have that. How do they communicate a superlative? Well, if you look it up, the word most holy is literally holy, holy. Holy, holy. So when you see most holy, you count twice. Do you know what the ultimate superlative of the Bible is? You know, but you may not recall just yet. 2 places in the Bible, Isaiah chapter 6, Revelation chapter 4. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord, God Almighty. Now, we're saying, there were holy men of God. There are aspects of worship that involve that which was most holy. But God towers above all of that when we're told he is holy, holy, holy. And when the four living creatures in the book of Revelation say, they don't get tired of saying that. They say it constantly. And we should, as we come in to appreciate our holy, holy God, we should do it with the reverence, filling our minds, thinking of nothing else. What else could compete with God in your mind? I know you can place anything that's foolish in it, but if you're thinking about God seriously, you want God to be in your mind. On your mind and in your mind. Now, I like making this point, and some that hear me preach love for me to take a hymn and say something. Marching to Zion. I'm hoping all of us are on the march and to the right place, not to be able to see a football game, not to go out to eat. Marching, a militant idea, to Zion. But that hymn starts off saying, let those refuse to sing who never knew our God. You see, singing is not a right, it's a privilege. A great privilege to worship the Lord God Almighty. And I like telling people, if you're not in a right relationship with God, we're so thankful you're here. But these are the songs of Zion. It belongs to the people of Zion. And they too have to be very focused when they sing these hymns. Well, one other verse, and I got the time. You know, when we're studying the book of Romans, I want you to go there. But a lot of times somebody will say, you know, to understand the book of Romans, I probably need to get a few lessons out of the book of Galatians. Oh, I would think so too. And why do we do that? We like knowing that Paul uses the same words, guided by the Holy Spirit, in those two epistles, talking pretty much about the same thing. And so we kind of say, I feel good when I can pick up on that and make a comparison. Well, Moses wrote the first five books of the Old Testament. And in Genesis chapter 32, what I've been preaching, my favorite key words are all in one verse. Really, in Leviticus chapter 1, I had to get you to span 20 verses to get my three words. In Exodus, or in Genesis 32, verse 20, you know the story. Jacob's coming back home after 20 years. And he has heard that Esau, is coming to meet him with 400 men. Now, how many men do you need to come and say hello? And by the way, Abraham had an army where he fought against kings, in the plural, 318 men. So does that give you a little bit of perspective on something that's even bigger? And Jacob doesn't have men to fight with him. He's got his family. And so he's frightened. But he comes up with a plan in his mind. And I want you to read about that plan. You already know he sent waves of gifts to Esau. Not all together at once. But one wave, then another wave, then another wave. I want you to see it. Verse 20. Behold, he wants everyone to say this to Esau. Behold, your servant Jacob is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me, and afterward I will see his face, perhaps he will accept me. To see someone's face, to have an encounter with the queen, with the king, you have to be granted permission for that. He wanted to be able to see it, and he knows that Esau has said when he left, he was fleeing. Esau had said, I'll wait till my father dies, but after he dies and I don't want to grieve him, I will kill Jacob. And he left for 20 years. Well, he wanted to come back and be accepted. I want you to see something else. He sent all those waves and he said, I will appease him. That's the word for atonement in the book of Leviticus. The very same word. What does appeasement mean? It's the idea of turning away wrath. He knows his brother is angry, and he wants to appease that anger. Turn away that wrath. Atonement deals with turning away the wrath of God. Grace. What is grace? We use the phrase unmerited favor, and that is a correct phrase. But it's not the complete definition for me. It's unmerited favor when wrath is deserved. And in this case, the wrath of God is deserved. When the wrath of God is deserved, that unmerited favor. Isn't that what we want? I'm not able to buy my salvation, and I can't send lambs and goats ahead of me before God. God's already the owner of that. This world is his world, and all the animals on the planet belong to him. I can't give him something that he couldn't take if he wanted it. Paul would say, I go to the psalmist for this. If he were hungry, he would not tell you. He doesn't have to ask, because everything belongs to him. And so I want to appreciate these words, appease, and the word present. Here I want to end. It's the word in chapter 2 for the grain offering, and the Hebrew word is mincha. That word is translated here as a present. It wasn't a grain offering, but it was a present. In the time of the judges, they would pay tribute when they were under Moab at that time to the king, Eglon. And they brought a present, a tribute to that king. That's what's involved in our understanding of the grain offering. It's not like I'm buying him off. What I'm trying to do is to let him know how much I appreciate. That's really what's involved in all worship, is to let the Lord know how thankful and appreciative you are. I can give you some homework assignment. You might like to find a text in the book of Deuteronomy that talks about what you would say when a grain offering was being presented. Let the Bible instruct you. And my final thought now. When I see how the Bible is so tightly knit together, it does more for my faith than lessons against evolution. Now, I believe it's good for us to learn that the lessons being taught by science, and it's in philosophy and all those areas, They don't know what they're really saying. But I don't know how you can overlook the connection between the Old Testament and the New, and that Testament period being spanned by nearly 2,000 years. It was in the mind of God. He had prepared us for this. We're time for a break.